If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
Yeah, and it worked really well. I mean, I went from paying $500,000 in tax 1 year to the very next year paying zero federal income tax. And it was through, you know, strategies that I was learning along the way. I learned a lot in a few short years.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Dave Zook is a successful business owner, syndicator, and investment and tax strategist. He has acquired more than $200 million of real estate since 2010, and that includes several thousand multifamily apartment units, multiple large institutional-grade self-storage facilities, and cleaner energy carbon distillation units that produce pharmaceutical-grade oil and liquids. His team is also one of the top five ATM operators in the country. Dave, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on your show. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, man, this is great. This is great. You've got a wild and very varied background. I'd love, you know, the same questions we ask everybody who comes on is where'd you start? Where are you now? And really, how did you get there? Because this is kind of a wild background. I'm excited to hear about this.
So I've been an entrepreneur all my life. I was raised in an entrepreneurial family. I saw my dad investing in real estate. I saw him self-manage some single-family homes, and I just decided I wasn't going to be a real estate investor at all. So fast forward a bunch of years, as I was growing up, in my late teens, I was very interested in business, and I started my own business, and I actually founded several businesses in my 20s. And got it to the point where I got myself in a tax situation. I remember where I was standing when I got the call that although they took all of my deductions and I paid my quarterly taxes and all that, I still owed a couple $100,000 in tax. And so, you know, paying $500,000 in tax a year, it just, you know, at the time, it, you know, the businesses I was involved in, it, and still am, it didn't even feel like work. I mean, I was working, you know, 15, 20 hours a day, but it didn't feel like work. It was so much fun. But when I had to give half of my money back to the government, it wasn't so much fun anymore. So I went down this path. I was studying and reading, you know, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and then pretty much everything else Robert Kiyosaki ever wrote. And he made this statement how that you can make $1 million, that you can make millions of dollars a year and pay no tax legally. And so I had to get close to him. I eventually was able to get in front of him and his tax guy and his whole team. And I was on the Real Estate Guys Summit at Sea. And so I got connected with some good folks, and I soon realized that real estate can be not only a good way to build wealth through, you know, different income streams, but it can also be a tax protection vehicle. And that caught my interest. So that's when I started investing in real estate, multifamily apartments first, and got myself in a position where I got my tax liability under control. And I really entered the real estate space with that thought in mind. How do I control my tax liability?
So you began investing in real estate so that you could control your tax liability. That's wild.
Yeah, and it worked really well. I mean, I went from paying $500,000 in tax 1 year to the very next year paying zero federal income tax. And it was through, you know, strategies that I was learning along the way. I learned a lot in a few short years. And one of the things that really helped me, and I would suggest this to all of your listeners who have businesses who are especially high net worth folks, is, you know, get a good CPA on your team and make sure he's open to strategizing, getting into your personal, you know, businesses and helping you strategize and navigate tax. And so I got one of the best tax guys on my team, probably one of the best in the country. And we're talking, you know, on a weekly basis. And so to be able to buy some apartment units and use cost segregation studies and accelerate depreciation and really, really change the way that I was doing business and change the way that I was investing, got me in a position where today, even, you know, decade later, you know, I quadrupled and more my income, but now my federal income tax rate is somewhere in the 0 to 3% range.
Right, right. And I think that's something that people commonly overlook, especially passive investors. They don't understand the tax implications of real estate. So that's really cool. How have you grown? You make it sound so easy. You know, like, oh, hey, I wanted to get my taxes under control, so I began investing in multifamily. But that requires a whole new set of knowledge and skills and, you know, implementation and knowing what to acquire. And I mean, even figuring out just exactly what it is you want to buy. How do you educate yourself quickly and then make decisions on things like that?
So I rely heavily on my teams. And, you know, as you can imagine, being involved in several different asset classes, I have to. I've got to rely on the teams that I partner with. I'll give you an example. I was a passive ATM investor for about 4 years until, and at the same time, I was building my syndication business. I was buying apartment buildings. I was buying, you know, I'm invested in self-storage facilities and all that. But at some point in the process, the guys, my partners in the ATM business, at that point, I was just a passive investor, but they saw I was building quite a list and quite a following. And they asked me to partner with them and join them on their team. So I became a partner, became very active in the ATM space. And, you know, at the time, that was a kind of a small friends and family type of a business. Today, we're, you know, a number of years later, we're one of the top five ATM operators in the country and have thousands of ATM machines out on the streets. But it's sort of like that. I tap into a really good team. I had, you know, 4 years of track record to make sure I liked these guys and make sure we worked well together. And then we went to market with it and really scaled the business. So I didn't try to, you know, really know everything about the business. I knew the team and I knew they did really, they were really good at what they did and they knew the space inside and out. So I tap into the team. I like to team up with really good people.
Right, right. No, that's absolutely right. And I think one of the things maybe that you were able to do is obviously you had the net worth and liquidity, I think, to be that passive investor partner and get that preview so that then you could team up with them. What would you suggest for somebody maybe that doesn't necessarily have the liquidity or, you know, the leverage in their checking account to do that?
So number one, many of these deals that we are involved in, you got to be accredited. And, you know, if you're an accredited investor and you want to invest in this space, find a partner, in whatever space you want to invest in, find someone who's already doing it, find someone who's got a track record, and you may have to borrow their track record. You know, early on, I was, you know, again, I was a passive investor, then I became a partner on the team. But nobody knew me as the ATM guy because I'm not out telling people that I'm investing in ATMs passively, and I just don't say anything. So sure. Nobody really knew about it that much. But when I went to market with the ATMs to my investors and then, of course, out to the general public, I had to borrow their credibility, you know, their track record. They'd been doing it for, you know, since 2011. I had to tap into their team and you know, management at higher levels in the team that had been working for, you know, Fortune 500 company, Fortune, you know, 100 companies in the space. So you may have to borrow some credibility, but, you know, jump in with a team that you know, like, and trust, and that has performed well in the past.
Right. No, I think that's a great point. That's a great point.
And figure out how to bring value to that team.
Yeah. I think both of those are super valuable. Let's talk the nuance of ATMs for just a quick second. I don't want to dwell here too long, but really curious what first sparked your interest in it and why ATMs?
So I was introduced to the team, you know, looking at the asset class and looking at the IRRs, the cash flow, the numbers, and the tax incentives. Because, you know, that's really what you're doing is when you're investing in an ATM, you're really not investing in the ATM for the ATM. You're investing in a cash flow stream and a tax benefit. The ATM is just a steel box. And really, when you dig even deeper, it's a real estate play. I mean, you're taking a 3-foot by 3-foot highly desirable piece of real estate and you're monetizing that space. It may be some of the highest per square footage in margin you can get out of any real estate deal. But, you know, I liked the model. I liked being on the receiving end of that $2 or $3 surcharge when somebody slides their card in and gets cash out. And then, of course, you know, the returns and the tax benefits and bonus depreciation and all that started to really make sense for me, because back at that time, and I still do this today, but it was very important to me when I look at an investment. Once I liked the asset class and I liked the cash on cash return, I needed to know what this did for me from a tax perspective. And it served well on several of those fronts, and I loved it. And I was invested in the ATM space in the seven figures before I took it out to my investor group.
Right, right. No, that's fascinating. That's fascinating. Okay, very cool. So then you went out, and I know you said you started really investing in real estate. You invested first in multifamily. What did that look like for you? I mean, are you still investing in multifamily?
No. The last I bought a multifamily apartment complex was in the fall of 2018. I've actually been selling quite a few of those complexes over the last 2 years. So I still have a bunch of multifamily, but I'm a net seller the last 2 or 3 years.
Gotcha. Why is that?
I have assets or asset classes that I like better, that I think deserve more of my time and attention. The margin is better. And so I decided to make the shift.
Right. That's interesting. Do you want to get into those on this show, or you want to leave those quiet?
No, we can talk about it. We already talked about ATMs.
And is that a space you're still actively growing your investments in?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We're very active. We got a fund open right now. The other space that I really like, and we've been involved in this space since 2016-ish, 17, is the self-storage space. And one of the things that really attracted me to the self-storage space was, historically, even when there's a recession, a pullback in the economy, disruption, any of that kind of thing, self-storage tends to do really well. And, you know, you look back to 2008, 9, and 10, you look back to 2020 now, you know, with COVID going on and stuff, and you see how well that asset class, you know, look at coming out of 2008, 9, and 10, that was the number one performing real estate, commercial real estate asset class amongst all of its peers. And not only was it the number one performing coming out of it, it was the least affected, negatively affected of all of its commercial real estate asset class peers. So it kind of gives you an idea of the stability of it. Love that space. We got a fund open right now in the self-storage space. We do a lot of self-storage. Just closed on one, I think, last week. And then the third thing is that I'm heavily involved and invested in is it's a carbon project down in Texas, where we take what's typically known as a dirty coal. It's a coal, and we run it through a patented process, big piece of machinery. It's like a giant oven, patented domestically and internationally. And we run coal through this giant oven at high heat and slow speeds. And at some point in the process, that coal breaks down and releases oil, gas, and liquids. And it's a very niche product. It's actually a pharmaceutical grade oil. When you go to the hospital and you shoot drugs into your blood veins, oftentimes that base product is coal. Well, when your wife dresses herself up and she puts her little cosmetics on, that's coal. Skincare products, it's coal based. So it's a very high margin product. And, you know, we're producing this oil and liquids and selling it under contract to household name buyers that you would know. And we're selling it for $182.50 a barrel.
Wow. Wow. How did you get into that?
I got introduced to the space through some investors in my network. And I went down to check it out. And I liked it. I liked the team. We got a little creative on the tax side. And I soon realized when I was looking at it, that I like, wait a minute, there's no reason we couldn't put this package together and structure it in a way that you could take the IRS code 469 that the oil and gas guys use. And we put it together in a way that you can offset when you invest in this asset, you can offset W-2 or ordinary income tax. So you can offset the tax liability on any kind of income, including W-2, which, you know, as many of your folks probably know, is one of the hardest to protect. So we were very strategic in how we put it together. We worked on it with professionals, and it's just a very, very good, not only cash flowing asset, but it's also a very aggressive, one of the probably the most aggressive asset classes I know in the form of tax benefits.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I've not heard of any sort of, so you're telling me that a passive investor can offset W-2 income?
Yes.
I've not heard of that before. Yeah.
So it's the same, it's modeled after how the oil, it's modeled after the same exclusion that the oil and gas guys rely on. And what it says, and you can look it up, it's IRS code 469, you can look it up and it'll tell you that you're not subject to the same active participation rules as you normally would be, like when you invest in a multifamily apartment building or ATMs or something like that. This is, you know, they're basically waiving those active participation rules, and you can take that tax benefit and offset your W-2 income.
Wow, that's awesome. That becomes very attractive for passive investors, I would imagine.
It is a very attractive tool that we use to offset tax liability for our investors.
Right, right.
And you know, we're not even mentioning the cash flow streams that you can get from it. That's, you know, well into, you know, IRRs in the 20-30% range.
Wow. That's fantastic. You've been involved in a lot of different industries. I know you said this earlier, you rely heavily on teams. What are some things, we've heard of things, you've obviously done a lot of really cool stuff. What are some things over the, I don't know, last 20 years or so, maybe that you would do differently?
Early on, I got jolted a few times by just simply getting into the, you know, getting into a good asset class, but getting into it with the wrong partners. So when you hear me talking about teams, it's not something that I was, you know, born with, some kind of instinct that I was born with. It's, you know, that got beat into me over the last couple, you know, couple decades. So, you know, I got some bad experiences, and, you know, almost all of my bad business or investment experiences had to do with dealing with the wrong people.
Wow. Yeah. And were you, I guess you're able to unwind most of those. And is there like what are some tests you use now to make sure that doesn't happen again?
Well, if you're in any one of those asset classes, let's just say self-storage, and you're a promoter or an operator in the space, and you cold call me and want to know if I wanted to invest in your self-storage facility, that would probably be a pretty short conversation. However, if I start hearing about you through other folks in the industry and through some of your investors, and, you know, they start saying all kinds of good stuff about you, now you got my attention. So I would say track record and, you know, what's the word on the street? You know, I'm, you know, our community of investors is pretty small.
Really
and
is.
So. And so if nobody's ever heard of you, that's probably not a good thing for you. And, you know, if there's a lot of, conversations on the street that are not good when they talk about you, that's not good either. But if you got a lot of people out there saying nice things about you, that catches my attention. And of course, you know, on top of that, I'm always much more careful when I'm investing my investors' money in the deal alongside mine than I am if I just go and do a one-off and start investing my own money in that deal. But if there's investors' money in the deal, you're talking, you know, background checks. I want to make sure you're not a bad guy. You know, we just recently finished up a background check where we went as deep as, you know, sending local attorneys to the courthouse to dig up old records and, you know, try and find out, okay, is there any way that we can pull dirt up on this guy? Because we're talking millions of dollars of investors' capital. And so, you know, when you can do that, that's all good. But it starts with having a really good reputation, a really good track record, and a lot of people on the street saying nice things about you.
Right. That's interesting. Yeah, that's absolutely interesting. And I think your point there that you are, I think when we're investing our own money, like there could be maybe potentially not quite as heavy vetting because we only have to answer to ourselves if we make a bad deal. like, ah, shoot, I should have known better. But when you're bringing friends and family and other people alongside, that adds an extra layer of real responsibility.
When you do that with your own money, you cry and whine and you complain and you're mad at yourself and all that. But at the end of the day, you go to bed at night, you can sleep. When you do that with investors' money, it's a whole other level and keeps you up at night.
Right, right.
Fortunately, many of my mistakes were made well before I was a syndicator.
Right.
Not that I haven't made some as a syndicator. I certainly have. But many of my mistakes dealing with the wrong people, many of those mistakes were made early on before I was a syndicator. And for me, I'm an investor first. Like when I'm out looking at deals, when I'm out, you know, vetting sponsors, I'm looking for where's a really good place to put my own money. And I may invest in that deal for 6 months, 12 months, a year or two. Well, in the case of the ATM machine, almost four years, I may invest in, you know, with that team with my own money for a good while before I introduce it to my investor group.
Right. Yeah, that's absolutely key. That's absolutely key. Dave, we're running out of time here. Let's jump into the final four if we can. What is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
Team up with the best people you can find in the space and give up a little bit of margin to do it if you need to. You know, many times some of those best deals that pencil out on paper, you know, that just look phenomenal, many times those are, you know, some of the most challenging to keep filled and keep the rent collected or, you know, make the numbers work. So whatever you can do to get close to really good folks that have a good track record and know their stuff.
Right. That's great. That's great. When it comes to investing in yourself, what is one thing you are currently doing to stay on top of your game?
I'm always reading and I'm always getting around good folks in their profession. You know, if I want to go and invest in, you know, something I don't know much about, Bitcoin, whatever, I'll go find the absolute best person in that space I can find anywhere. But no, just, you know, getting around great people and reading good stuff. I read a lot.
When it comes to investing in the world, what is one thing you are doing to make the world a better place?
Yeah, so a couple things. In our carbon project, when you're talking about making the world a better place, I'll go green on you for a little bit. So we used to flare all of our excess gas when we ran our coal through the process to collect the oil and liquid. Now we capture that gas. We're at the size and scale where it makes a lot of sense now to capture the gas. And so we're more than 99% emissions free. So that was my green talk there for a little bit. From making the world a better place, a couple of things. I'd like to mentor investors. I really like to do it to investors who I know are going to go out and make a difference with, you know, not just buy a Lamborghini, but go out there and impact their community and really do a lot of good to the world. And then I also have a donor advice fund where every year I collect assets and put it into my donor advice fund. It's a 501c3. I can give out of that donor advice fund and the assets continue to build in that fund. And, you know, since I'm the real asset investor, I don't just write it. Oftentimes I'm not just writing a check. I'm putting assets into the fund that give me give me ongoing cash flow that I can fund stuff that I believe in.
So how does that, I'm just asking here for clarification on that one. That's really cool. So are you taking either, you know, equity stakes in a company or shares in a company, and instead of holding that in an investor's name, you're putting it into your fund?
No, I'm not doing it with investors' money. I'm doing it with my own money. Right. So I'll give you an example. I'll at the end of the year, I may put an ATM machine in that donor advised fund. Now the revenue, the monthly cash flow from that ATM machine gets poured right into the donor advised fund. And then you can go out and write a check to some 501c3 or some organization that you want to support.
Right, right, right. Yeah. And I probably had a convoluted way of saying that. But yeah, that's kind of what I was trying to get at, was that there are income producing assets inside of that fund. Yep. That you can then continue to write checks out of. I think that's really cool for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is that it continues to produce more money and things that you can give away, as opposed to, oh, we donated, then that donation went out the door and that's the end.
Yeah, and you know, it's a long-term play for me. I want that fund, that trust to outlive me and make an impact to, you know, organizations that I believe in that are important to me long after I'm gone.
Gotcha. Man, that's awesome. That's awesome. Dave, thanks so much for your time today. Certainly appreciate it. If our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
You can go to our website at therealassetinvestor.com, or you can reach out to us by email at info@therealassetinvestor.com. And we have reports on all of these asset classes that we just talked about, and I'd be happy to send them out to your listeners if they reach out to me with that email address.
Awesome. Dave, thanks so much for your time. Certainly appreciate it.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.